go to any game marketplace, IRL, or online, and you'll see plenty of nostalgic nods to the 8 and 16-bit eras. In the past 5 years, we've seen so many popular games take on the retro game aesthetic. Shovel Knight, Fez, Flappy Bird, Papers, Please, I'm sure you can think of many others. As a scholar of retro game aesthetic and 8-bit art theory, I've been interested in why the 8-bit pixel style has such great popularity today. What motivates people to take on this aesthetic? I'm also an NES homebrew developer, so while I obviously have a soft spot for the retro game aesthetic, I've been feeling a little overexposed to it lately in indie games. So, is 8-bit art dead? Should we just throw this stylistic trope in the trash? I don't think so, but what I'd like to talk about today is how you, as a game developer, can refine your approach to retro game design and use pixel art in a way that meaningfully connects to your game's content and concepts, as well as with your players. We'll hear from David Washington, a developer on a unique, collaboratively created game in which artists iterated on a pixel art theme. I'll also show how an understanding of old consoles' hardware restrictions can actually inform modern-day dev decisions. All right, let's roll the thing. So, you want to make a retro pixel art game. Cool, let's talk about that. I think there are a few questions you can ask yourself as a game developer that can help you to craft meaningfulness from that aesthetic choice. And the first question, of course, is why? Why have you chosen to employ a retro 8-bit aesthetic? What does pixel art do in your game? What atmosphere does it create? I typically hear a few reasons why developers incorporate pixel art into their game. Those reasons are ease, minimalism, and nostalgia. The concept of ease, meaning that creating pixel art doesn't require complex art software or precision illustration skill, I can really appreciate. But I want to talk a bit more about these notions of minimalism and nostalgia. I've heard some developers say that they use pixel art to achieve a minimalist look, one that's uncluttered, simple, streamlined, or even timeless. It's not about nostalgia, they'll say, but about being as creative as possible within some given constraints. And absolutely, working in a pixel art style can give a very simple and minimalist look, and it can force really clever creative solutions through its constraints. But at some point we need to say, well, it kind of is about nostalgia, because pixel art is a very specific implementation of minimalism, right? Like, there are a lot of ways to be minimalist. Think about the history of minimalist art. Think about Donald Judd. Think about the refined and exquisite geometric forms of Bruno Munari's Useless Machines. Think about color forms. Where are my Donald Judd video games? Where are my Bruno Munari games? Pixel art is not the only way to embody minimalist, simple, elegant aesthetics. And indeed, there are some gorgeous interactive experiences that completely eschew pixel art, but pull off beautiful simplicity. Games like Vib Ribbon for Sony PlayStation, and apps like Osamu Sato's iOS illustration software, Maru Sankaku Shikaku. If minimalism or creative constraint is really your aesthetic goal as a game developer, I would urge you to think outside the pixel-shaped box and explore these other forms. Now, about nostalgia. It's a complex feeling. It's a longing, a desire for something lost. I'd like to summarize my thoughts on it with a focus on best practices for developers. So let me give this a try. Number one, what are you personally nostalgic for? It might not be an 8-bit style Metroidvania, and that's okay. I encourage you as a developer to think back to your personal memories and pull from something that's meaningful to you. Maybe it's playing skee-ball or getting snow cones on your way to the neighborhood baseball card shop. Something that has your heart and soul in it is going to be so much more powerful and meaningful. And secondly, building on that, nostalgia is often described as a bittersweet feeling towards something lost. And to be perfectly honest, games like Galaga and Mega Man aren't lost to time. You can go out and buy these games right now on contemporary platforms. Now, Galaga and Mega Man might be nostalgic because they remind us of a childhood lost. That is, if we're grown-ups and we played Galaga or Mega Man when we were kids. I know, blasphemy, heresy, you say. How can you tell me that Galaga isn't really nostalgic? Well, I'm playing devil's advocate here a bit, only because I want to encourage you to really think about whether nostalgia is important to you in your game and what statement you're making with it. I'll give you an example from one of the games I made a few years ago. Electronic Sweet and Fun Fortune Teller is a horoscope and love tester game for the NES. It has a very old school vibe to it, and I mean, look, it's on an NES cartridge. It's got all these retro touch points. I find this game very nostalgic, even though horoscope video games were not common or popular in the 8-bit era. It reminds me of my childhood, being interested in magic and fortune telling and romance stories. And this game is a little bittersweet for me precisely because it didn't exist in the real world of gaming, and I think it would have been something I would have really enjoyed and wanted to play when I was a kid. So you've heard me talk about the 8-bit aesthetic and retro game politics, so let's hear from someone else for a moment. David Washington, a fellow Microsoft developer, had a unique opportunity to work with an art gallery on a pixel art game slash exhibition. David explains how this project came to be.
So I heard about this gallery called Light Gray Art Lab, and they were doing some really interesting stuff with installation art. The thing that really stood out to me the most was a paper doll installation where they essentially had 30 artists each create their own paper doll. I went and I tweeted at one of the owners of the gallery and I said, hey, do you know what we should do? Is we should make games and every artist will create their own level in a game. And what was really interesting is the folks that ran Light Gray Art Lab said, hey, you know what would be really interesting and what we've been trying to do is make a pixel art exhibition. So if we're gonna do a pixel art exhibition, why not make a pixel art game that is in itself a exhibition of that art? So I was the developer on the project. There were over 100 artists that submitted for the call for art. And the gallery selected 30 artists to participate, and each of those 30 artists followed a set of strict rules around what sprites and background images and types of animations that they needed to create for the game. And then the folks at Light Gray Art Lab and me were able to integrate them all into one complete game that is Dream Arcade. And what was really just exciting was to see how each artist interpreted the goals of the pixel art genre differently. And we definitely gave the artist a lot more flexibility to, you know, create parallax and actually create some higher resolution images so they could showcase some of their illustration skills. So you ended up with something that was a little bit of a hybrid of that retro and the modern kind of illustrative techniques. The thing that I really liked about the show in general is even though every artist had a different style, it all kind of came together as one game. So to me, it just showed that you know, pixel art is really something that we all think of differently. After we completed the game and we coded it all up, the folks at Light Gray Art Lab designed all the levels and created the story. We hosted a gallery opening over at the Light Gray Art Lab space, and hundreds of people descended in the gallery space. We had tablets with Xbox controllers mounted in the walls, and everyone got to play the different levels. And it was really that experience of everyone enjoying the art for what it was, while actually being able to play it and enjoy the story, which was really neat, really unique. They went on to releasing the game in the App Store so people could download it and play with it on their own. We see a lot of pixel art in indie games today. In a sense, when I think of pixel art, I don't think of it as the constraints of 8-bit hardware in the early NES days. I think of it as the idea of applying constraints to your game design. And really, if you choose really strict constraints, both visually and in your gameplay, and you really stick to them, then I think the sort of soul of what makes those 8-bit games so desirable can shine through.
So maybe after hearing all of this, you still have your heart set on pixel art and you think it's a really good fit for your game. I want to leave you with a few design tips and ideas around building an internally consistent pixel world. One thing that's really worth the time investment if you are looking to situate your game's aesthetic within a certain game console era is to go and research the hardware constraints that gave these consoles their unique look. Let's think about the NES, for example. If you do a quick internet search, you might learn that the NES is capable of displaying a 256 pixel wide screen with 53 to 64 unique colors, depending on who you ask and whether they're counting duplicate colors. If you followed these guidelines, you might make something very lovely, but it wouldn't really follow the NES specifications. Let's take a look. While we have 64 possible colors on the NES, not including tinted variants, they can't all be used at once. NES backgrounds can only display a maximum of 13 colors at a given time. That's 4 color palettes, containing 3 unique colors each, plus one color that's shared across all 4 palettes, giving us 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13. Now, I have here a screen mockup that's 256 by 256 pixels, representing one background screen of an NES game. Now, in reality, this entire screen isn't viewable at once. The viewable area is more like 256 by 224, but we'll leave it like this for now, just for simplicity's sake. NES backgrounds are made up of 8x8 pixel, non-overlapping tiles that are laid out on a grid like this. Each of these tiles can have one and only one of our palettes applied to it. So a tile can have these 4 colors or these 4 colors, but not 8 or 12 or 13 at once. And in fact, color palettes are applied to 2x2 tile areas or 16x16 pixel areas. So if this tile has palette 1 applied to it, so must this tile, and this tile. Another visual constraint in NES games is the number of unique tiles that can be normally displayed at once. Here's our 256 by 256 pixel background area. At 8 pixels per tile, that's 32 tiles across and 32 tiles tall. That would give us a total of 1,024 tiles on screen. Unfortunately, we can only display 256 unique tiles on screen at once. That covers only a quarter of the screen. Now, we could put our highly detailed game in a small inset like this, but what most NES games did with this constraint was to reuse tiles over and over. Remember, we have 256 unique tiles, meaning that we can reuse a tile without it counting against our total. A sky is solid blue. That's just one tile reused over and over. A field of grass is made up of a repeating 8-tile pattern of green dots. More significant tile savings. This is why nearly every letter in an NES game's font can fit within an 8-pixel square. Designers want to be able to reuse these letters over and over while minimizing the number of tiles they take up. You can see that the NES is much more restricted than a cursory glance might suggest. The point of this exercise isn't to be slavish to the past. By all means, break the rules, do something different. But as with any creative endeavor, an appreciation for methods from the past can be of great benefit. And if you've gone to great lengths to recreate an NES-style look, something like vector text or too much color density or sprite rotation, something that the NES didn't have, can dislodge the illusion that you're trying to create. Pico 8, which is a Lua-based fantasy 8-bit console, is an example of a game IDE slash game platform that does this retro aesthetic really well. It has a passionate cult following because the constraints, which are today totally arbitrary, are nonetheless consistently applied and thematically strong. If you haven't checked out Pico 8, I really recommend it. It's a great, very fun, very clever environment. And it's also a good example of how to break the rules of the past while also being informed by them and taking care with those special, authentic touches. So I hope this has been illuminating to you, that it's given you some ideas about how to think about retro aesthetics in games. You might not agree with everything I've said here, and that's okay, but if some piece of this helps inform how you approach game development, I'm very happy with that. So let me know about your game development projects and how things are going on Twitter. You can find me at PartyTimeHexcellent. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.